today.
Impact Directories. Bigger print, better book.
News and talk. That's what we do. News Radio 560 KPQ.
This is The Agenda from News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com, where topics of local concern affecting you are open for discussion. And now your host, Michael Knight.
Good afternoon to you. 26 degrees here in Wenatchee. And to tell you the truth, it's kind of balmy at 26 compared to some of the temperatures we've had. I went out and walked around a little bit in Wenatchee Town. I advise if you do the same that you have skates on the bottom of your boots or your Trax Wax or whatever you use to stay on your feet because it's a little slick out there. Now, today on the daily show that we call The Agenda, I ask you to consider this. Death and taxes. Somehow they always appear next to one another. They're always a wandering around hand in hand. Personally, if I had to choose, and my only choice is death or taxes, I always hesitate like Jack Benny did when he was approached by a robber on the streets demanding your money or your life. But Jack Benny doesn't say anything. He hesitates with perfect comic timing, and the criminal says, I need an answer. And Jack Benny says, I'm thinking. That's where I am right now, leaving me to ask, death, where is thy sting? Taxes, I know where your sting is. There's certainly no waiting for the sting of the tax man. It's always functioning, always seems to be especially sharp this time of the year. And it's always following a conversation of the so-called tax break, which some people love, but some most people don't understand, and some people say it is a nightmare. Well, okay, maybe it's a combination of all those things. It's best appreciated as it severs your fifth vertebrae with a pathetic whack. Now you feel better? By the way, I have returned without warning to our theme of death and taxes. There's one other force that defies time, your mental state, or any manner of wriggling, and that's gravity. You drop your 1040 in the trash. How does it get there? Gravity. You launch yourself off a convenient skyscraper because you can't make your payments to the IRS. Why do you descend? Gravity. Also, gravity takes care of any second thoughts you may have had on your way down, which the 1040 cannot cover. And speaking of entertainment, which that was, let us welcome our very special guests, Tim Dilley and also Kyle Meisner, returning to The Agenda to spread enough truths to calm the choppy waters of tax season, despite what I may have said. Welcome to the show once again, gentlemen, and thank you for being here during what would normally just be a regular boring tax season, but not this year. There's fear and loathing afoot, isn't there, Tim?
Well, biggest tax changes in over 30 years. So we're dealing with lots of things to think about, things to contemplate, things to address, and then figuring out how to address them.
And thank God you're the authority on this. Now, if you were to consult Facebook on this matter, people are wringing their hands and shouting, you know, from the rooftops that something terrible has happened to their tax, their 1040 every year. Well, should they have seen this coming, or do they just really, really, really not understand what we're dealing with? Because I think I'm in the latter group.
I think people should have appreciated that when the tax tables were updated back in February or March, depending upon when your employer implemented it, that you got a raise, and you may have noticed it back then, but long since then forgot about it.
I mean, you got to keep some more of the money that you were already earning.
There was more in your paycheck, and that was because the federal income tax withholding that you had previously got lowered a little bit in anticipation of you paying less tax on your tax return. But, you know, if people have become accustomed with a particular size of refund, and now suddenly they're not getting as much refund, they're disappointed, right?
And so the best way to handle that is withholding.
Well, yes, absolutely. And in many cases, your tax did in fact go down, but your withholding just went down more. So you have a smaller refund, and people equate that to I must be paying more taxes, when in fact that is not correct.
But in fact, you paid less tax, and that's why you have to pay more tax now.
Right, you paid less tax, but you withheld less throughout the year. And so, you know, it feels bad now that you're doing your tax return and you
usually get
$1,200 back and now you're only getting $800 back. And it's like, well, this didn't work for me. When in fact, if you really analyzed year over year, the total tax, it may have went down, but your total withholding went down more.
If you have a question for Tim Dilley and also Kyle Meisner, both of them from Cordell Nair, they're CPAs, they know their business. I like to say they know their onions because it takes it beyond just knowledge to actual application of that knowledge to something that's going to save you money and save you a lot of tears and crying. Here's the number to call. to talk with Tim, because you don't want to talk with me about it. I know, and I don't blame you. 509-663-5656. Again, that's 509-663-5656. And if what Tim just mentioned to you about your paycheck and withholding and your return and what you can expect this year in a check, if you get one back on a regular basis from your government, and you don't understand it, don't you want to know the ins and outs? Call me now, 509-663-5656. Is the IRS up and running better than it was a couple weeks ago when the shutdown sort of, well, they have reduced staff, then they had the shutdown, and then I don't know. How are they coping?
Well, they're back to work. I read an article that said they had 5 million pieces of unopened mail awaiting them upon their return from that period of shutdown. So
no doubt.
My warning that I've been giving to clients of any issues where we require the response of a human with the IRS is have extra patience this year, because that correspondence is going to be submitted and is going to be waiting in a line for a while.
Stick a call. Hey, you're on the air with Tim Dilley at KPQ. Who's this?
This is Don.
Hey, Don. Thanks for calling. You have the floor.
Okay. I sold a house that's not my primary residence, and I have capital gains. I just want to make sure that I have the right forms to report the sale of the house and then all the remodeling that I did to the house, which I get to subtract from the sale price.
That's right. That adds to your cost basis.
Right, right.
So what forms do you need? You need two forms, Schedule D.
Okay.
And then you're also going to need the, 8949? And I can't remember the letter number for... This is going to be a long-term capital gain. So would that be a D form, Kyle? In any case, the 8949, which then there's different letter series for the 8949 based upon whether it was a short-term capital gain or long-term capital gain. In this particular case, I assume that you own that property for more than 1 year, which would then characterize it as a long-term capital gain. And you didn't receive a 1099-B, B as in boy, because you wouldn't for a real estate transaction. So I forget what letter that is, but it's the last letter in the series of the 8949. On that form is where you actually record the sale. And when I have a sale of an investment property, I usually say something to the effect of land and building and then the address. And what you're going to report is the gross proceeds. So the total amount you sold it for as the sale. And then in the cost basis column, you're going to have a few different components. You're going to have the original purchase price of that property back whenever you bought it. You're going to add to that cost basis improvements to the property that you made over time. And then the last thing you're going to add is your sale costs, the cost of selling the property. Even if you didn't use a real estate agent that charged you a commission, you paid real estate excise tax on that sale. So I know you've got at least some cost there. That information is on your closing statement from that.
Oh yeah, I have lots of costs.
Yeah, so those things in total are your cost basis of that home. And assuming that you never used it as a rental and took depreciation, your gain would then be the difference between the sales price and the cost basis, and that gain is your net long-term capital gain that would be reflected on the 8949, and then it just sort of rolls up to the Schedule D, and from the Schedule D, it rolls to your 1040, or now it rolls to a schedule that shows up on your 1040.
Yeah, I have filled out both those forms.
Okay, great. Sounds like you're on the right path.
Yeah, other long-term investments like stocks and so forth. So.
Yep.
So, hold on 1 second, Don. He mentioned the deduction of the cost to remodel the home, preparing it for sale. Where does that go?
Yeah, sure. That adds to your cost basis. So let's say sometimes you have to fix something before you sell it. Like maybe you had to put a new roof on it to make it saleable. And sometimes those things are negotiated either in the sales price, so the new owner takes care of it, or you take care of it before it sells. Either way, In this case,
we did a lot of remodeling, such as all new carpeting, remodeled the kitchen and the bathrooms and so forth.
So that adds to your cost basis of the home.
Right. And then we put it up for sale.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Did we answer your question, Don?
You did.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your listening. Thank you so much, Don. I appreciate that one.
The cool thing about that gain is it's long-term capital gain. It gets preferential tax treatment under the tax code right now. So
how preferential?
Well, if you're in the lowest two tax brackets, so married filing jointly, that takes your taxable income up to about $77,000. If part of that $77,000 consists of that long-term capital gain, it's actually taxed at 0%, which is pretty preferential, Michael.
That's a very small number, zero.
Once you get it above the, once you cross into the next tax bracket, the 22% tax bracket now, then you are paying 15%. So you're paying on that long-term capital gain a tax rate that's less than your ordinary income tax rate.
So if I buy a house that originally cost me $1 million and I sell it for $5 million, but I put $2 million of improvements in it, my deduction is $2 million from the sale price?
Your gain is $2 million on that. And then you'll be paying a little bit higher than 15% or 0%.
Well, I was using round numbers.
Those are round numbers, all right.
But I wonder if how does the IRS determine if those are actual figures?
Oh, the actual cost basis?
Well, my improvements that provided me with such a nice deduction.
Well, of course, you'd retain your receipts of all those improvements, right, Michael, so that you have that in your tax documentation should you come under audit questioning your cost basis of that transaction.
Sometimes when you're figuring out your deductions based on donations you may have made to charity in kind or in cash, all you have is that one receipt. But if you file electronically, there's no place to show that.
No, but you retain it in your tax documentation.
And you're okay with that?
That's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
And if it is called into question, and typically those type of audits are what we call correspondence audits. So there's not a guy in a suit showing up at your front door saying, let's go through your tax return. It's a letter from the IRS that says, hey, you had a really large charitable contribution in relation to your income and the norms. So you got selected for a correspondence audit. Please send us the copies of the documentation that substantiates that deduction that you took.
Have you ever had an audit or sat through one?
Absolutely. Yep.
I have too. And I was scared to death. Because it was my own fault. I realized when I saw the return that I had made an error.
Yeah.
But they were absolutely, and I know this sounds ridiculous, they were wonderful. The guy I had didn't want to talk about business. He wanted to talk about radio. He wanted to talk about all the stations that he listened to. He wanted to know the inner workings. Yeah. And I was gobsmacked, as they say. I expected a very stern exchange of views. And they couldn't have been nicer. Now, I knew going in that I was in the wrong or that it was going to cost me.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a surprise. But what did surprise me was the demeanor.
Yeah.
And this was a big, ugly IRS building in El Monte, California. Not really the most welcoming facade to walk into early in the morning.
Yeah.
Gray desks and gray walls. But a really interesting guy on the other end that made it a lot easier for me to stomach the procedure.
Right.
I hope that's been your experience, too.
You know, it depends.
That's the best use of that answer yet.
Our favorite answer, right?
Sometimes it's more harsh.
It turns out that IRS agents are human, and so some are nicer than others.
Yeah.
We get a few characters that you wouldn't really want to have a cup of coffee with.
No, you would. They're throwing their weight around a little bit.
But I would say often it is just somebody trying to do their job.
Right.
And, you know, I'm sympathetic to that. And especially when it's just honest mistake like your case, you know, there's no arguing about it. Like, yeah, I missed it. Sorry.
No, I was.
Might as well talk about radio because we're done here.
Thank God. Thank you. We wanted to talk about something.
Yeah.
Not only that, but they worked out a payment plan that it was affordable and reasonable. No arguing, no arm breaking. It was everything that I did not expect.
I was going to mention when you were talking about the alternatives of jumping off the building or paying your tax. Paying your tax.
I was using those as examples, of course.
because as I tell people who say, golly, Tim, I can't pay that, this is probably one of the friendliest areas of the IRS is establishing payment plans. My experience has been is that they're pretty accommodating, flexible, willing to hear, like, what can you do? They do not really want to drive you into bankruptcy. They don't want to close your business. That really is not in their best interest. And so if you just have a tax bill that's just too large to pay, I mean, there's several alternatives, including entering into installment agreements with the IRS, which if the tax isn't too large, is almost an automatic process, and you can even do it with the filing of the return and set it up to be EFTs for some amount on some particular day of the month on a monthly basis.
Also, if the IRS agent shackles you with a deal that's good for the government but very bad for you, and you can't keep up your payments, what kind of a deal is that? The government doesn't get their money, you don't get relief, and they don't get a good scene.
Right, right. So they don't want to put you in that spot where you can't put food on the table because you're paying the taxes. And like I said, they're pretty accommodating. I think the installment agreements can go as long as 72 months.
Wow.
Which is a pretty long time.
So there's a guy who knows all the ins and outs. Tim Dilley and his associate, Kyle Meisner. Say something, Kyle, so we know you're here.
How you doing today?
There he is, ladies and gentlemen, the voice of reason. It's 12:30. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll ask Tim Dilley what's crossed his desk this week that amazed him. Ooh, I've never seen that before. And in the meantime, take your little finger and pick up your phone. Good job. Now, dial this number, 509-663-5656. 663-5656. If you don't have a question for Tim Dilley this year for this complete change of many people's tax reality, then you're just not thinking. So get your thoughts straight and call me right now.
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio. The Agenda with Michael Knight on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
26 degrees in Wenatchee at 12:35. I'm Michael Knight. My very special guest, Tim Dilley, and also Kyle Meisner from Cordell Nair. We're talking about tax tips for this year, where so many things have changed. In fact, I just heard a story from Tim that we're going to talk about next. But first, let's take a call, see who's with us. Hi, KPQ, you're on the air. Who are you, please?
This is David. I turned 70 and a half last year, but I still work for the same company part-time. I believe I didn't have to take any withdrawals last year.
Okay, so I think that is correct. If you're still an active participant with that 401k, I presume, at work,
right,
at age 70 and a half, because you are still able to contribute to it, the IRS does not force you to do the RMD, the required minimum distribution.
Because I'm only working part-time, I'm not allowed to still contribute, but I am still working for the same company.
That's a good question then. If you're not eligible, you may be subject to that RMD. That's a really interesting question. If you're not eligible to contribute to the 401k anymore, to me, that might suggest that you don't fall under that rule that says you don't have to take an RMD. You know what? Let me kick that one down the road, and we're going to bring the definitive answer to that next week, because that's interesting.
Oh, good job, David! You win the award today for stumping the panel. Excellent. And to go over it one more time, he works for the same company where he began his 401k.
Yeah.
But if he's not contributing, then it goes into a gray area.
And it's really about the eligibility of being able to contribute.
I'm not able to contribute because I only work part time.
Right. Right. So by losing that eligibility and turning 70 and a half, you may be subject to the RMD, which is a really important thing to know whether it is or isn't, of course, because RMDs, required minimum distributions, are required, and it's a calculation of the value of your 401k at the end of last year, so December 31st, 2018, and then in year one, it's roughly 3% of that balance is your required minimum distribution calculation. And if you don't do it, and you should have done it, you can be subject to as much as a 50% penalty on what the RMD should have been, which I, of course, would appeal, but it's a pretty serious amount by missing it. It's something that we are very aware of with our clients that are subject to the RMD.
And how, if you have $1,000 in your account, how much do you have to distribute? 3%, you say?
Yeah, so that, if it's $1,000, it's not very much, but Hopefully by the time you reached.
Well, my last example was in the millions, so I brought it down for you.
Thanks. back to Earth.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it. Did we answer your question?
Partially, yeah.
Yep. Okay. And so I'll make sure that that next week, I think Sean is here next week, I'll pass the question to him to make sure that we have the definitive answer to that.
So that's Thursday next week?
Yes, sir. 12:15 Thursday.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David, and I appreciate the call. Here's the number to call if you want to get a question in like David did, 509-663-5656, 563-5656. Or 663.
That's an important question there, and so I would hate to tell him that he doesn't have it and then later find out that he does have the RMD requirement. That's why I would prefer to be able to look that one up.
Well, we'll get that figured out. Now, if you own properties that you rent to other people or you rent from someone that that you love dearly as your landlord, there's a new rule that's going into effect, and Tim, I don't think anybody knows about this.
Well, they may not because it's about a month old. So let's step back first, and so listen up, landlords.
We have so many calls. Would you hold off on that one? We'll pick a couple of seasons on. Hi, KPQ, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hi, this is Dale. I have a question about the W-4 form.
Okay, you have the floor.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering what it looks like at this point, the W-4 form that you that you fill out for your employer, what that form looks like now that we don't have exemptions.
Have you looked at it, Kyle?
I believe that the form looks the same, but there's no more exemptions to go off of anymore.
Unfortunately, I have not really been through the rigor of the W-4, but, you know, since we've lost our personal exemptions, that's sort of no longer the great gauge of what you should have withheld. So
you may be able to see one online if you want to take a shot at it on the IRS page.
Yeah, go to irs.gov, G-O-V,
yeah.
irs.gov.
Search W-4.
And under forms, W-4, it'll bring up the most current W-4 that's been that's either been preliminary released or is released. And I do know that it's different, but I just don't know the math off the top of my head of what their process is now. But it's a similar process of how much do you make, what is your filing status, so the major drivers of kind of what gets to your taxable income, which typically is pretty okay for getting to your withholding set. The traps of W-4s is if you have multiple jobs, let's say you work part-time at two different places, they are each going to under-withhold if you only take into account what you make at that one employer. So that's where you need to make sure that you, when you're answering those questions on the W-4, you're looking at your total income, not just your income from that employer.
Yeah. So you also have the option of asking that payroll accountant to withhold more or less from your...
Yep, or even just withhold this much, you know, setting the actual dollar amount.
Okay.
I have some clients that do that just because they've dialed it in and that's the number they know they need to have.
It's your money. I don't see any reason against that. That's a good idea. Good idea.
You know, because they may have other extenuating circumstances, like maybe they, maybe they pay alimony, so they have a big deduction because they are paying their ex-spouse, and that's a deductible to them because it was a divorce decree prior to 2019. So things like that can, you know, it would be a shame to over withhold all year. And not appreciate that on the tax return.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, Dale. Go to irs.gov and you'll be able to see all the forms there for your W-4. All right. I thank everyone who's called in. Our number is 509-663-5656. Now, I will not rudely interrupt Tim again. Let's find out the answer to the question about what's facing landlords.
Okay. Landlords, listen up. So all year long, we've been saying, you know, there's this new 199A deduction, which is 20% of your net business income or maybe net rental income. And we said maybe because we didn't know if rentals would rise to the level of trade or business activity. Doesn't that sound silly? We don't understand a very rudimentary concept of is a rental activity a trade or business, because that's what this deduction, this 199A deduction is for. well, why don't we understand why it's not, is or isn't a trade or business, is because the IRS didn't define the code section under which to look and find out if that was a trade or business. So we waited all year long, got through December, didn't get any word, but then mid-January, we finally received guidance. Guidance that's actually retroactive back to 2018, of course, right? Apply some rules that we didn't know about all year long, so, you know, you either get lucky or not. And what are the rules? Well, to me, the biggest rule is that in order to rise to the level of a trade or business for a rental activity, this is residential or commercial, you have to have active participation, which under this particular case is defined as 250 hours per year. That's 250 hours of rental activity. So not investment activity, which would be the financing of the rental, the acquiring of the rental, the sale of the rental. This is the rental activity, collecting rents, doing maintenance, getting lease agreements in place. And if you don't meet that 250-hour threshold, then you have not risen to a level of trade or business and therefore would not be eligible to take that 20% deduction on the net income of your rental activity. Now, if your rental activity isn't making you any money, well, then you don't really care. But if it is, in fact, making you taxable income, then you potentially have this benefit if you can meet that participation rule. For 2018, the IRS said, since that's already passed, you don't have to record that activity. However, for 2019 and going forward, you basically have to be journaling the time spent, dates, activity throughout the year to prove that 250 hours of active participation in the rental activity. A couple other things that can kick you out. If it's a triple net lease, this would be more of a commercial type of arrangement, a commercial rental, where you have told the tenant you're going to pay the taxes, the insurance, and other costs of the building. So effectively, they're doing everything. You are totally hands off. Well, that basically, the IRS says, if you have a triple net lease, you're out.
No, just no. Out.
Just out. You're done. But the 250-hour requirement was the thing that really seemed, I guess, onerous, in particular with having to document that throughout the year. So I've given the heads up to a few of my clients already that I was thinking of because they have rentals that make money and need to be aware of that because we're in the time that they should be documenting. And I want to make sure that if they meet the 250-hour requirement that we get that preserved.
So if your landlord is in Poughkeepsie and you've never met him or her, can they install a representative in the town?
That's where it gets hard. You know, if you hire a property manager and they're doing all the fixing of toilets and collecting of rents and everything, I don't know how you're going to get to 250 hours from, where was it, Poughkeepsie?
I believe Poughkeepsie, yeah.
So they may be out, which just means that they don't get the 20% deduction on the net taxable income of that rental activity. Again, if they're losing money on that because of depreciation or a bunch of repairs that are happening right now, getting it kind of refurbished or things like that, you don't care because the deduction is derived on the net income of that rental activity. But if you're making money, it's nice to be able to have an extra 20% deduction on that net income of the rental. But you have to have that participation.
You must service your clients or your tenants in a way that many landlords are not accustomed to doing.
Yeah, you know, that's about 21 hours a month, and that's kind of a lot in a month, I would think. But I know I have a number of clients that absolutely have that. It's just if it's the one-off rental that you have, you know, you bought it as an investment and sounded like a good idea, it may still be a good idea, but you may not be able to get the 199A deduction.
That's Tim Dilley. Also, his associate Kyle Meisner's here. We're doing tax tips for yet another day. We're going to do them every Thursday all the way through tax season. Our time is 12:47. We'll be back right after these words.
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KP. Don't let the winter weather get you down. Go get everything you need to go out and play in it. And if you'd rather stay inside where it's warm, Hooked on Toys also has a huge selection of board games. Hooked on Toys and Sporting Goods, 1444 North Wenatchee Avenue.
I want to hear it. Can you make some noise for Hooked on Toys?
News Radio 560 KPQ, 1253 is our time. We've got to say goodbye to Tim Dilley and also to Kyle Meisner. Kyle, you have 30 seconds to tell us about the SHA, whatever that is.
The Health Savings Account, HSA.
Yes, sir.
You can still make a contribution for 2018, which would be tax deductible. The limits are $3,450 for individuals or $6,900 if you're covered under a family plan.
And how do you think people should manage their HSAs? Do you advise people to do it? Yes, no, or?
Well, you have to have the qualifying insurance to be able to do it, but if you've done that legwork to get that set up, it's a great way to get some bang for your buck on medical expenses, which are otherwise a hard thing to actually get deductibility for. But with your HSA, which again requires that high deductible insurance, you can take that deduction as a page one deduction.
And the one proviso is don't put too much money in it.
No, that's
the
where
FSA.
You were thinking of the old FSAs that you would use it or lose it. So if you didn't use up your balance, it effectively would disappear, which doesn't feel very good and sort of doesn't really come out cost effective and tax effective.
So you go to your doctor and he says, "This doesn't seem to be anything wrong with you." And you say, "Yes, there is, my FSA. Treat me."
We used to set those FSA limits to, you know, just really those known base costs, the orthodontia things, the glasses, the prescriptions and whatnot. With the HSA, you have the ability to take it up to the maximum, even if you're not going to incur those medical expenses, because it will be there someday for when you do have those medical expenses.
I like that account much better. Tim Dilley and Kyle Meisner from Cordell Nehrer, thanks so much. We had a good show today. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Michael.
The Wild are home this weekend for their final two home games of the regular season as they face the